We are studying the book of Ruth, and we're going to be at the beginning of chapter 2 today. If you're familiar at all with this book, then you know that there was a family that left Israel because of a famine. There were four of them. We went to Moab, which was not all that friendly with Israel. The father, husband died, Elimelech. The two sons married Moabite women, and then eventually, about a decade later, both sons died. And last week, we got Naomi home with one daughter-in-law who had converted to faith. The other daughter-in-law had gone back to the false gods of Moab, and they come back to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest, which is the first of the series of grain harvests there. And so they're coming back at a good time. The famine has ended. There are going to be crops. There's going to be some revenue for somebody. The economy is improving, but they have nothing. And so they're coming back very poor. They have to figure out how to live. No husband, no anything. And this is where we pick the story up today. Ruth chapter 2, and I'll read verses 1 through 9. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "This is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Now he goes on, but we're going to stop there. Can't do all of this in one session. It's been said that for every 100 people who can handle adversity, there might be one who can handle success. It's an interesting reminder that success is not easy to handle. I would argue, though, with the numbers, because I think it might be equally hard to handle abundance or poverty. It is very hard to be at either extreme in society. We don't think it's going to be hard if we had the money, because everybody wants to go there and try it. I'm sure I could do it, you know. Give me the money. Let me try it. I think I'll be happy. But it's hard. It's very, very hard. In the book of Proverbs, a man actually prays not to be given riches or poverty. It's in chapter 30. Verses 8 and 9, this is his prayer. "Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I may not be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God." Being wise, this guy knew the pressures are intense at either extreme. Now, in this part of the book of Ruth, we have an extreme contrast between those two positions in life. Boaz is a very, very rich man. Ruth, at this point in her life at least, is a very, very poor woman. Boaz has servants and houses and properties. Ruth is reduced to begging permission to pick up what the servants have missed when they harvested the crop. She's asking if she can have the leavings, if she'll go pick them up. Now, each of these stations in life brings with it significant pressures on the character of a person. Whatever's in there is going to come out, and either one of these extremes will bring it out in a pretty intense way. You see all sorts of unattractive behaviors in the very poor and in the very rich in particular. And yet these two people don't show us any of that, one of them at each extreme. And instead, we see in them the most noble examples of character traits that God puts into the hearts that he has changed. Even at that point in life when the pressure is the highest, what comes out when they're squeezed is admirable, wonderful characteristics. Now, before we look at the details of those characteristics, I have to say that what we are about to look at, when it really comes from the heart, when it's not a contrivance, these character traits are not produced in human strength. Sometimes people pretend to have them. Sometimes people are really good at acting noble and wonderful, and they know how to put on the front, and then you'll get a glimpse when they're under pressure and you realize that wasn't the real thing. That was the veneer that they wanted me to see. But when this stuff is real, it doesn't come from any human effort at all. It has to be put there in the heart by God himself. He has to come in as an invader from the outside, eliminate the sin problem, and replace that wicked, hard heart with a new heart that loves him and that is inclined to good. Now, Naomi and Ruth and Boaz all lived long before anyone knew exactly how God was going to do that in a fallen heart. They looked to God to fix it. They didn't know how he was going to do it. They had little shadowy glimpses, some of them in this book that we see. But they knew God had to do it. They knew it could not come from human strength. And so they humbled themselves before God. They asked for mercy, and God provided what they needed. Now, we live in a very different time. We have long since had the whole Bible. There will be no more Word of God revealed. It is closed. It is done. And it's done because it tells us everything that God intends to tell us in this life. It tells us exactly how God produces this change in the human heart. It tells us that Jesus died on the cross to pay for the sins of all who would believe. And that by that work of Christ on the cross, people are reconciled to God. The Bible tells us that everyone who believes in that provision that Jesus Christ made on the cross by his blood, by his death, everyone who believes that provision is already saved forever, already has all of his or her sins forgiven forever. The problem is solved. The heart has already been changed if you believe this gospel. Naomi and Ruth and Boaz had all been changed in this way because they were looking forward to something shadowy in the future that God would do. And everyone who is saved now is saved by this same work on the cross, by this same Christ, but we have the great blessing of being able to look back and realize exactly what he did. And we can know it because God told us in his word. They believed that God would provide for their salvation, and God did. We believe that God has provided for the salvation of all who believe, and everyone who knows that to be true and loves that truth has already been changed. Their hearts are already different. If you're a believer in the gospel that Jesus Christ is the only way to heaven, that his death on the cross makes the way for you to be reconciled to God, then God has already put into your heart what we're going to be talking about this morning. And my point in bringing this up is not to say to anyone, look at this example and try a little harder to do good. That is the response typically of the human heart, but that is not what the Bible teaches us to do, and that is not my point this morning. If you're a believer, you can live a godly life because God has already changed your heart. If you're not a believer, you don't have a chance of doing what is done already in these hearts. You're just acting. And you may fool us, but you're not going to fool yourself and you're not going to fool God. But if you believe in the provision that Jesus Christ made on the cross, then the radical transformation happens in your heart. And then these things are things that God has already done in you, and you just live them out. That's why even under pressure, they're still there. It's not a facade. It's not just external. It isn't the whitewash over a tomb full of decay and corruption. From the very core, from the very inside, these changes have already been made. And no matter how hard you squeeze, when you get to the very middle, it's still lovely. Only God can do that. And if you're a believer, God has done that in you. However you may fail occasionally, however low you may feel over your own sins, if God has changed you, it's in there. If you've believed the gospel, it has happened. And so you don't produce the change in your character. God already did it. And your job now is to walk in what He has made you, to be who you are, and to live as one to whom all the riches of heaven have already been given. Now, before we talk about Ruth and Boaz, I do have to mention Naomi one more time. We've been talking about Naomi a lot. Somebody said last week, shouldn't this be entitled Naomi? She's gotten more press in this book than anyone else. Well, it's about Ruth because of the line of David and the line of Christ coming through her. But we do need to mention Naomi because she is the one who knew that she had a rich relative. Boaz is rich. It's a small town. Everybody knows who's rich, even if it's not a small town. Everybody knows everything in a small town. And she knew that her husband who had died had a close relative who had great wealth. Boaz is her in-law. He is very rich. She cannot help but know it. And yet Naomi, having been changed, as we've talked about in prior weeks, has no expectation that Boaz has some responsibility to step up and fix her troubles. She does not say, well, you know, he ought to do something because he can afford it. He ought to do something because he wouldn't even notice it missing. These two things are true, but she does not assume that she knows better than he knows what to do with the money that God has given him. She doesn't go and ask him. She does not go to Boaz as soon as they get back into Bethlehem and say, you know, Boaz, if the Lord lays it on your heart, why don't you help us? It isn't her place to do that. God has given him wealth, and with that, the responsibility before God to be wise with his wealth. He may very well help her, but it isn't for her to say. It isn't for her to hint. And she doesn't. I used to work in medical equipment leasing and financing, and I knew a lot of rich people who were lost. I have also known a lot of very rich people who are saved. The one thing that all of them seem to have in common, lost or saved, is a long line of relatives knocking on the door asking for money. You know, we don't need to do that. That rich relative is not your provider if you have one. That's God's job. Talk to Him about it. If you're in hard times, as Ruth and Naomi are here, you don't sit around thinking how easy it would be for somebody else to fix it for you and getting more and more discouraged all the while. Ask God to provide. He is the provider. And this is what Naomi is doing. And if she were not trusting God as her provider, then her mind would immediately go to the human opportunity of a rich relative. I mean, after all, he's rich. He can afford it. He probably has an empty house right around here somewhere. He wouldn't even notice the food missing, and we could live fine. But the note in verse 1 about Boaz's wealth is here because the reader needs to know about this because of what's coming in the story. It's not here because Naomi has decided to work him. She already knew he was rich. And she's not working him. And she's not looking for a way to put her troubles on him. And she's not trying to think of a way to get him to do something because he can. And she's not sitting around getting more and more angry that he hasn't done something yet. After all, he could have given a very large love gift by now. She isn't thinking that way. Now, if you're in hardship, you should be honest with people about where you are, as Naomi was in the passage we looked at last week. Don't call me pleasant. I'm pretty bitter right now. It's been hard. We're hurting. She didn't lie about it. She didn't pretend. But you don't start thinking about what everybody else ought to be doing for you. It's not healthy. It's not wise. They are not your provider. God is the provider. Talk to him. If he wants to lay it on their heart, he can do it without you making the suggestion in that lingo that we love to use around church folks. Now let's think for a minute about Boaz and Ruth. I just want to show you some demonstrations of this character. Remember, they're being squeezed really hard, and this is not an act. This is just what's in there. Just as they come up in the text. Look at verse 2. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Now, it's possible that Naomi's age or health prevented her from doing any of this kind of work. But Ruth is planning on obtaining what they need to survive by work, by her own efforts. Ruth expects to work. You may have noticed that this is a trait curiously lacking in most poor people. She plans to work for what they need. Israel's laws made specific provisions for the poor. Israel's laws actually commanded generosity from those who had it, but in such a way that the poor still worked, because work is healthy. There was work in the Garden of Eden before the fall. Work is not part of the curse. Only the toil came with the curse. And so there's generosity, but particularly for those who will work. One of the provisions is in Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. It's the one that Ruth is already thinking about. It says, "Now when you reap the harvest of your land," so this is written, a command to the landowner, "Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." So God is commanding the landowner in Israel to leave a little bit around the edges and not to go back over after the harvest and pick up what's been missed, but to leave that so that anybody who's needy or who's not from around here and having a hard time getting a job can, if they're willing to work, walk out into the field of another person and pick up what they need. The leavings were to remain there for the poor and for the needy who were willing to work. Now, if you know how people are, you recognize that not all landowners would have applied this command with equal enthusiasm. And if the landowner were not willing to apply this command, there's nothing that the poor person can do about it. You come into the field and it's been picked clean and there's nothing left over there on the edge, and what are you going to do? Or if they're about to come get it, come pick up the leavings, and you're stepping up onto their land to get it, and they say, "You get out of here," what are you going to do if you're the poor guy? There's nothing you can do. That guy has to obey. You can't make him do it. But that was the situation. That was the opportunity that Ruth is thinking of. And Ruth makes no protest that this kind of work is beneath her dignity, or that it's not her station in life to have to beg for the leavings. You know, this probably was far beneath anything she had ever had to do before. But she needs to do it, and she's going out to do it. And then she asks permission, which is another interesting insight into the character of this woman. She's talking to Naomi. Naomi knows more than Ruth knows. She's from around here. She's got a lot more years of following the Lord to learn some wisdom. If there's a better idea, I want to hear it. If there's a cultural blunder I'm about to make because I'm not from here, I need the warning now before I make somebody mad. Is this a good idea? This is what I plan to do. She's ready to hear some feedback. And Naomi says, have at it. It's a good idea. I want you to notice, too, in verse 2, that she recognizes that her ability to work and do this is at the discretion of the landowner, and there's no angst in her over that. She says she wants to glean after one in whose sight she finds favor. After one in whose sight she finds grace. She is not looking for her rights. She is looking for grace. She is thinking in terms of grace rather than entitlements, of kindness rather than I have my rights. This woman is humble, willing to work, asking permission, and thinking about grace. Verse 3 contains another one of those ironic phrases like what we saw in chapter 1. It says, So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now, we know it didn't just happen. And the author knows it didn't just happen. I mean, he's the one letting us know how this all ends, right? He knows that God is orchestrating these events. But he writes it this way because from Ruth's perspective, it just happened. She doesn't know. What this means is she's not working him. Nobody's setting Boaz up to manipulate him, to stick the need in his face, to try to work on his sympathies. It isn't like that. She's just going out to do what she knows she needs to do, and this is how it happened. Nobody's looking around Bethlehem saying, well, you know, Boaz could. We just need to give him a chance to let God bless him. They're not thinking that way. It's a tribute to the change that God has brought about in their lives, that they are resting in Him in the worst circumstances of life they've ever faced. That's not an easy thing to do. Really different from how most people think. All of those thoughts would have come into their mind just like it would come into yours, and they rejected them. It's not that they just didn't occur to them. Of course it would. They rejected it. You're like, that's not right. No, we don't do that. God is our provider. Now in verse 4, we get a glimpse into the character of Boaz. It says, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. Now, like the other young preacher in this room, I've had a lot of part-time jobs in my life. I've done a lot of he didn't even know. Young, you? I've done a lot of different kind of jobs. I've done a lot of labor kind of jobs. And so something hit me about this that might not have hit you, but I've done the grunt work. Worked my way through seminary in Texas, roofing in the summertime. This is a busy time. This is hard, hard, hot, dusty work. It's a harvest. You don't get it in, it ruins really fast. So you got to move. Long days, hard days. Now, it's an exciting time because it's been 10 years and we haven't had a good harvest, and now we have a good harvest. But that just makes it all the more critical to get it in and make up for lost ground. And it's a very, very busy time. Even if it were a normal harvest, it would be a really hard, busy time. But it appears this is an abundant harvest, and that means you have to do all that much more work in the same amount of time, right? If you don't get it up, it ruins. Now, Boaz is a very rich man, and that means that he has a lot to do. and a lot of pressure on him to get it done. A lot of people depend on him. He could lose a lot if this thing doesn't go well. He's got people in this field, and he's got people in this field. He has to trust these stewards to watch these servants, and everybody has to pull together and get this done, and he's got a lot of pressure on him. Now, I have found in my life that excitement or pressure to get something done, either one of those will bring stuff out, right? But neither the excitement of this finally got a harvest thing or the pressure seems to do anything to upset this man's equilibrium. He comes up to these servants and gives them a kind and respectful greeting that reminds everyone that we're all in this together under the Lord's provision. May the Lord be with you. This is not how people have talked where I've worked when the work has been hard and hot and dusty. The boss does not generally open with, "May the Lord be with you," when it's intense. Why does the author tell us this? It's not extra. It's to give us an insight into the character of this man. This is unusual language in the hurried, weary work of that critical time. And if a man will speak this way in that circumstance, then this is how he thinks. This is what's in his heart. He cares about his men, wants them to be blessed of the Lord, wants the Lord to guide them in their efforts. It is at once a prayer and a greeting, and must have been completely consistent with this man's character. And the servants respond immediately by saying, "May the Lord bless you." Not, "Yeah, I hope he's with you too." "May he bless you." Find me some hot, dusty, tired employees who want the boss to be blessed, and I will show you a godly man. You have to be a little more just to overcome the natural prejudice against the boss, right? If those beneath him want him to do well, he has demonstrated godliness in their presence before this greeting. In verse 5, he asks about Ruth. This means that he is attentive to people. He has noticed the little person. And he asks his steward for a report. Now, this report gives us as much insight into Boaz as it does into Ruth. Look what the steward says in verse 7. In verse 6, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from this morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. Now this is the head steward, at least over this particular part of the work. He knows his boss. He has said yes to Ruth's request to be there and work, although the boss was not there. He did not have to go, "Well, let me check with Boaz and see if that's okay." He already knew. "I'm not going to get in any trouble for being generous in this field." Because she's still there. So he had to say yes, right? And so he already knew that in this household, the biblical command to leave those corners and not to go over the field again is obeyed because we are generous with the needy in this outfit. I don't have to ask about that. I already know that. "Yes, ma'am, help yourself. Whatever you need." Kind of selfishness that would squeeze out the needy is not anything this guy's worried about with his boss, and so he doesn't second guess this at all. Doesn't run her off because she's a foreigner. Doesn't have to ask if it's okay. Now, his answer to Boaz goes far beyond the surface level of who she is, which he did state in verse 6. He knows his boss. And so after he explained who the woman was, which was the strict answer to the question, He gives the rest of the information that he expects his boss to want from having previous experience with the guy. And his answer means that Boaz is a man who cares about people and about what they're doing and about what kind of character they have, how they present themselves, what they're doing when he's not looking. Every boss wonders about that, right? Is this just eye service? What's up with this person? And so the steward is ready with a very concise, very wise report because he knows that his boss is going to be interested and wants to know the character of this woman. Just this brief answer says so much about the working relationship and the kind of man Boaz was, but it also tells us an awful lot about Ruth. Because, note first of all, she asked permission to collect the leavings. Now, this was not a requirement laid out in Leviticus. That book commands the owner of the land to leave the gleanings, but it doesn't establish a protocol for who can come in and get them or when. It just says leave them so that they can get them. And so many people in Ruth's position might assume that they could do whatever they wanted once those guys had been through that field once. I have my rights. But there's none of that kind of presumption in Ruth. She doesn't have an entitlement mindset. So she doesn't saunter up to this guy and says, the Bible says you have to let me have this, so don't you give me any lip about it, okay? I know my rights, so don't you even start with me. I'm ready for you. I can quote Leviticus. She asks permission to do what God had commanded them to let her do. Why would you do that? Maybe because you're concerned about other people and having good relationships with them. And maybe because you're humble. You want to show respect to the landowner? You want to show respect to the guy who's in charge of this field right now when the landowner is not here? You don't want to offend anybody? You don't want to stay if you're not welcome because you know God's going to provide and he might want to provide for you somewhere else, and so you ask to do what they're supposed to let you do anyway? She asked. This head steward also points out to Boaz that Ruth has demonstrated a good work ethic. She's been hard at it all day. She only just now sat down to rest for the first time. Because when he came up, she was resting. She'd been sitting there all day. I don't know. The steward tells her. She worked hard. When I was a roofer in Texas in the summertime, I had a boss who had a real soft spot for people who had made some bad mistakes in life. And so every couple of weeks or so, he would bring us a new helper from the halfway house who had just gotten out of prison, and they were at the Salvation Army for 2 or 3 months. And he would go by and pick up whoever was willing to work. After a while, they wouldn't come out. You know, it's hard work. But it was funny to watch some of the people just kind of, all this activity was such a nuisance to them. And they would just look at it like, what is all of this movement? This is really strange to me. And they're just walking around. I'm going to get the nail and tap. Tap. You know, yeah, I'll work, but not hard. She's working. She's been hard at it. She only just now sat down to take this short rest. This is a glowing report from a wise steward who knows his boss, and it tells us the kind of person Ruth is. She's not half-hearted about this thing that she probably didn't enjoy doing. She needed to do it, and so she did it well. Now, to all of this, Boaz responds by treating Ruth with kindness. He's just nice to her. In a couple of weeks, we're going to look at him being nice to her. I don't have time today. But this is, I mean, the biggest part of this is he's just nice, he's generous, but he doesn't come in and say, okay, here's a house for you to live in and an annual salary. You know, he's just like, stay here. I've told my people not to mess with you, and they'll keep anybody else from messing with you. And you hang out with these ladies, and when you need a drink, you get the drink here. Don't worry about, you know, we'll share. And you can rest in this shelter when you need to rest, and I'm going to feed you lunch. I mean, that's nice. It's not an annuity plan, but it is nice. We'll talk some more about that in a couple of weeks. But for today, there's one other person I have to mention in this story. And that person is God. He is the one orchestrating these events. He is the one who gave wealth to Boaz and gave him the character and the wisdom to handle that wealth with grace. He is the one who gave salvation to a Moabite woman and brought her to Israel by his grace and gave her the strength to live in hardship for a time, demonstrating the change that he had brought about in her heart. God is the one in this story bringing these two people together. They have no idea at this point they're going to be married, but God knows. They have no idea that they're going to produce a child together, let alone that that child will be in the line of King David and then in the line of Christ himself. They don't know this. In the midst of all of this confusion and all of this difficulty for Ruth and the busy activity of the harvest for Boaz, God is working an eternal purpose. He demonstrates faithfulness to meet Ruth's needs, to meet Boaz's needs. He was a lonely man. It appears that Ruth felt extremely isolated and alone. You can only imagine how she must have felt. She had to be wondering if this is just all it's ever going to be. Still a young woman, am I going to be this poor and scratching to get by for the rest of my life? Or is there going to be some change? She doesn't know. I want you to note what she says in response to Boaz being so nice to her. Look down at verse 13. Then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. She is keenly aware that she does not look like everybody else. She's the foreigner. And she's hurting. She demonstrates tremendous character, but that doesn't mean it was easy. And it's an insight into how hard it was for her that the guy is just nice to her and she just gushes on him. She can't believe somebody's nice to her. This is hard. And yet in the midst of all of this difficulty, all of this uncertainty, Almighty God Himself is working an eternal purpose in her life. A blessing that goes far beyond her life. The thing I want you to get out of this today, if you're a believer, is that that is true of you. Because the Bible says, God is no respecter of persons. If you feel isolated and alone and lonely and troubled, and if somebody just says, I hope things are going well for you, and you just, oh, thank you for being nice. God has not forgotten you. God is faithful. He is working His purpose in the lives of all of His children, just like He is doing it right here in this story. We see it because we've read the book. She doesn't see it yet. It's by faith that we live, trusting this is true for us, everybody. We don't know the future. And so if you feel all alone and desperate, or if you feel troubled and heartbroken over some failing in your life, or if you've got circumstances weighing you down and you wonder if it'll ever get better, I want you to be reminded by these examples that your God is faithful. He is faithful to you. His character is perfect. There's nothing lacking in His power. There's nothing lacking in His faithfulness. And so in your life, his purpose is being accomplished. There's nothing to hinder it. If his power is perfect and his faithfulness is perfect, just because you don't see the end of this doesn't mean that God is out of options or that he has forgotten you. If God has changed you at all, then he has changed you from the inside out. He's already done the biggest thing. He's given you the kind of character that Boaz demonstrates in wealth, that Ruth demonstrates in poverty. And your objective in life is to live as one whom God has changed. The Bible uses the expression, walk in it. Walk in it. Ephesians 2:10 says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we would walk in them." Who did the work in that sentence? It wasn't you, hotshot. That's the good news. "Which God prepared beforehand that we would walk in them." We are so often tempted to imitate this world, to pursue the things that they pursue, to value the things that they value. It's so refreshing to see an example like these two, and Naomi, these three, to remind us of the changes that God has wrought in our hearts through his grace so that we can act like who we are, so that we can live our lives trusting him, so that we can be encouraged to deal with the stuff that comes up without forgetting who our provider is, without forgetting who is working his eternal purposes in all of this. And when you can remember that, when you can remember that he is faithful and that he is accomplishing his purpose even in the midst of your suffering, then you can rest in him. You can walk as one whom he has changed. We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. Let's bow in prayer, please.